From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Police strategy in St. Petersburg backfires as the African American community organizes.
They held up a leaflet that we put out saying the killer cop had gotten off and that the community need to get together to talk about it. Held it up as some kind of extremist language that could thereby justify everything that they did. In other words, if we don't say it the way the chief of police or the mayor of the government wants us to say it, then they can set us up, destroy us, attack our building and children and women with tear gas, and everything is going to be all right.
Also, the FDA no longer requires informed consent in some human experiments. Is this good for science or just for business?
Companies want to do this research. Companies were not allowed to do this research. And we have to be mindful of the fact that there are economic incentives, and that's one of the reasons why we put in place lots of the different protections, such as data and safety monitoring boards, so that we can shut a study down as soon as it looks as though one group of people might be disadvantaged by the research.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Some Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill are expressing concern over the proposed deployment of 4,000 U.S. troops to Central Africa. Ben Gilman of New York chairs the House International Relations Committee. He says the Clinton administration must insist on a real ceasefire before any multinational force moves in. Dan Coats of Indiana, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, says the administration has good intentions but no clear goals. He says it's acting as if the memories and lessons of Somalia have been forgotten. President Clinton today is expected to announce U.S. plans to participate in the multinational relief force, but he's also expected to insist that the warring parties in eastern Zaire pledge not to interfere with the operation. And President Clinton yesterday prepared to announce U.S. willingness to participate in a new international peacekeeping force in Bosnia, a step that would reverse a long-standing commitment to bring U.S. troops home from the Balkans within about a year. At a White House meeting with Clinton yesterday evening, the president's top foreign policy advisors laid out the case for extending the U.S. military presence in Bosnia for a further 12 months until the end of 1997. Expenses to date of this operation, $3.3 billion. Election regulators denied the Green Party's bid to become a national political party, citing presidential nominee Ralph Nader's decision to spend less than $5,000 to avoid filing campaign reports. The Federal Election Commission voted 5-0 yesterday that despite fielding Nader and 8 congressional candidates, the party fell short of the scope of activity required for national committee status. Green Party attorney Mike Dunley said he would recommend an appeal. "We got the 4th highest vote total for president," Dunley said. "We'd like to be treated the same as the Democrats and the Republicans." Nader also criticized the Commission of Democratic and GOP appointees, saying it was discouraging the growth of alternative parties. He said, "To give the reason that a person didn't raise enough money or spend enough money, that's really monetizing the definition of a candidate, isn't it?" Nader was on the ballot in 22 states, finishing well behind the reelected President Clinton, Republican Bob Dole, and Reform Party nominee Ross Perot, in a field crowded with lesser-known candidates. With more than 580,000 votes nationwide, less than 1%, Nader outpolled the nominees for the U.S. taxpayers and natural law parties, both of which have national committee status. And Republican Woody Jenkins challenged his narrow loss in Louisiana's Senate race yesterday, claiming the signatures of thousands of voters don't match those on voter registration cards. Results certified Wednesday gave Democrat Mary Landrieu a victory margin of 5,700 votes. Documents obtained by a federal grand jury suggest that a Texaco lawyer gave instructions on how to withhold damaging records from plaintiffs suing the company for racial discrimination. This according to the New York Times today. Texaco executives denied wrongdoing and said the documents were never subject to discovery. Texaco is facing a $520 million class action lawsuit brought by 1,500 black Texaco employees. The grand jury is investigating accusations that Texaco executives used racial slurs against blacks in a secretly recorded 1994 conversation about the case. And today's execution, a man who gave up appeals to hasten his execution, was put to death by injection early today for murdering a couple in their home just 2 days after he was paroled. This in Columbia, South Carolina. Doyle Cecil Lucas wanted to die and was filled with remorse, according to his lawyer, for the 1983 murders of Bill and Evelyn Rayfield during a burglary. But in his final statement, Lucas criticized the state for, quote, bringing itself down to a level of the people who have themselves killed. And you're listening to Democracy Now! On Wednesday, a grand jury in St. Petersburg, Florida, refused to indict a police officer for shooting and killing an 18-year-old African-American named Teron Lewis. Anticipating an angry response to the acquittal, riot-clad police flooded the mostly black neighborhoods of St. Petersburg's South Side. Police also targeted local political organizations, including the African People's Socialist Party. They raided meetings of groups and arrested community activists. In response to the verdict and the police action, hundreds of local residents took to the streets Wednesday night. Police fired tear gas canisters at crowds, and the National Guard was placed on alert. One officer was shot. Seven other local residents were reported injured. Police arrested 9 people. Joining us to talk about the situation as it continues to unfold is Amale Eshetela. He is the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, a community group active in St. Petersburg, South Side, and now at the center of police activity. We're also joined by Rob Lori, news director at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I want to welcome you both to Democracy Now! Amale, can you tell us exactly what has happened since Wednesday, since the grand jury refused to indict the police officer?
We've learned something subsequent that explains some activities of the police, but I can tell you that when I arrived to our office after having left a meeting with the African-American coalition at around 10 to 3, about 8 to 10 carloads of police were there, arresting a member of our organization whom they had just pulled over for what they said was a license plate expiration, that his license plate had expired. He was handcuffed, thrown in the back of the police car. When I arrived and walked up, the young man who was with me was immediately identified by the police as a person who they also had a warrant for. The presence of the police by now has resulted in perhaps 100, 200 people gathered around. This is 3 blocks away from where the police had killed Teron Lewis on October 24th. And feelings are still running high because of that, because of the police had been actually running amok in various communities, apparently retaliating against the people for the rebellions on October 24th. So now the people are really angry about the police presence here. The police rush us who are standing between them and the person who they have identified, and for nothing. I mean, it was a complete falsification. They pushed us against the wall, pepper sprayed me and Kinar Zima, who is the president of our local organization here, and I'm incapacitated by this. And when I wash the stuff out of my eyes, they've got this guy. They've arrested the person, Lindsay Williams, who was with me, and the crowd is extremely upset. So this is perhaps all of this takes place. Perhaps it's now 3:15 or so. Before this, the streets were relatively calm. Nobody was really out on the streets. But now the streets are full of African people, and there are hundreds of people standing on both sides of 18th Avenue, which is where our office is, in front of our office, just standing there. What happens is that we're also planning for a 6:30 meeting, our regular 6:30 Wednesday meeting. And we had passed out leaflets telling people that this meeting we were also going to talk about the verdict and how we had to organize to deal with that. The police, by 6 o'clock, they block off the streets to prevent people from coming to the meeting. They actually, ministers who are part of the African-American coalition, were turned back. Some people were threatened with arrest and or death should they attempt to come to the meeting. At about 6:30, when we are inside the building, perhaps 70 to 100 people who live in the community are in the building, someone comes forward and says that the police have announced on the bullhorn that we have 5 minutes to get out of the building, that they've declared the meeting an unlawful assembly, or they're going to shoot tear gas into the building in 5 minutes. I began to try to talk to the people to get them out the rear exit. There's babies, children, women, men in the building, and within 30 seconds after that announcement, they begin to shoot tear gas into the building. People are panic-stricken, trying to get out of the building. Our building is surrounded. They fire volley after volley of tear gas. In fact, they exhausted the entire supply of tear gas that they had in the city of St. Petersburg, firing at our building. We are surrounded. They fire tear gas into trees in the back of our building, setting them ablaze. And when the people in the community attempted to extinguish the blaze, which threatened our building and threatened vehicles parked in the back of the building, they would fire tear gas to try to drive the people away, although the very courageous community took that away. That was the first fire that we were aware of. And what is clear, in our view, among other things, that we're looking at a protected speech question, a question of whether or not we have the right to put forth our views, when the police chief can actually say that we arrested them and we found people using the color of law, that we could find any warrants or any other reason to arrest them who are associated with our movement, to take them off the streets because they were concerned with what we're going to be telling the people after the verdict. When they can block off the streets, denying me the right to speak to the people and denying people the right to come to a meeting, when we can be in a meeting and they can declare it unlawful and shoot tear gas to disperse the community because they don't like what it is that we say, what we believe, and what we were going to say to the community, is clearly a protected speech question. Yet they define us as the reason for the uprising. And this has been a thing that's been going on since October 24th, and it's clear that they have identified us as a force they want to move. It was a provocative action by the police. Even if they had not planned to take people off the streets with these sweeps, and even if it were a legitimate arrest around the expired license plate, to send 8 carloads of a special weapons team to arrest somebody when tempers are high because of that verdict, and to come to the center of our movement, was clearly an attempt to provoke the community and to set up a situation where they could close down our center and perhaps kill. And everybody was seeing another move scenario where they'd be able to justify trying to wipe us out. They held up a leaflet that we published, and the leaflet said something like, "Killer cops set loose," and called the people to come out. They held us up as some example of extremist language, that we are not supposed to be able to say that. If we don't say what the police like for us to say, if we don't say what the mayor or the city government like for us to say, then therefore they are justified in doing what they did.
We're talking to Amalia Shetela, who is chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, also called the Uhuru Organization. What does Uhuru stand for? What does it mean?
Uhuru is Swahili for freedom.
I've been reading a lot of the press reports about what happened, and in every single one, they mention somewhere, usually very close to the top, that the Uhuru group, that the African People's Socialist Party, has called for the execution of the officers who were involved with the October 24th shooting of Teron Lewis. Have you called for their execution?
No, that's a blatant lie. What did happen, and this is the problem they have, is that they are accustomed to have, particularly in the kind of community that we function in, a voiceless community that can be described as a permanent underclass, a drug-driven, drug-ridden community and what have you. And they're not accustomed to the people being able to articulate their own aspirations and interests, and that's what the Uhuru movement does. So what happens is that a week after the killing, we had our own tribunal to investigate what had happened and had actual witnesses who had seen the murder of Teron Lewis come forward very courageously to testify to the community what they saw and have people in the community be able to ask questions of them. We had 3 persons who we asked to sit as judges, one a doctor of theology, another a community activist out of Tampa, Florida, well-respected in the African community, and another community activist in St. Petersburg. We asked them to bring back a rendering on a couple of questions. One, whether Minor and Knight were guilty of murder. Those were the cops who were involved in the killing of Teron Lewis. Whether Darrell Stevens, the chief of police, and David Fisher, the mayor, were guilty of genocide as defined by the United Nations Convention on the Crime and Punishment of Genocide. The people retired and came back and said they felt compelled to do more than just speak to the charges given to them, that all four of the persons were guilty of murder, and all four of the persons ought to face the death penalty in the electric chair, in the state's electric chair. That was what they came back for, with the clear assumption that what they were talking about was a legal execution in the state's, and the state's electric chair. So that's what was stated. And what happened was they took that and said that we were calling for the death and the execution of the public officials.
Hmm. Amalia Stella, we're also joined by Rob Lori, news director at WMNF in Tampa. Rob, you've been covering these events. You went to the news conference yesterday of the African-American coalition that is forming and have also been monitoring the media's coverage down there. Can you tell us what the local TV and radio are saying?
Well, local TV and radio, I think, has been pretty provocative. The television stations have reported on O'Malley's movement as if it just sprang up yesterday, and they give no sense of the history of this organization. It's been in town for more than 15 years, has been in the forefront of pointing out police brutality, and some of the television stations view it as a kind of an alien force that just plopped here in the last few months, which isn't true. The radio stations have been quite provocative. The commercial radio stations have gone on the air. One talk radio show host suggested that the Uhuru House be napalmed. Other people suggested that carloads of people go down and attack the Uhuru House. White people go down and attack the Uhuru House. I think the media has done very little to try to bring the sides together and focus on solutions. The media has done a good job of trying to spread people apart and raise the tension. And I got to say that outside of the Bay Area, I don't think folks in the rest of the country realize how tense the situation is in St. Petersburg.
You know, you were saying yesterday, Rob, that one TV anchor, local TV anchor, held up the flyer that I believe Amali was just talking about that called for this meeting. And what did he say it said?
Well, he said that the flyer called for the execution of the police chief and of the mayor and of the two police officers. I think what the anchor was doing was editorializing on the air, but there was no indication that this was an editorial. In fact, the anchor went on to blame the Uhuru House people and the African People's Socialist Party as the instigators of this unrest, as if there wouldn't be any unrest if they would just go away, which I don't think is the case. But I think that anchor, who is one of the most prominent anchors here in the Tampa-St. Petersburg area, you know, deliberately raise the level of tension. And I don't think that the media has been very responsible in trying to find out what the issues are and how we can solve those issues.
Amalia Shatella, what about this African-American coalition that's forming? This is new, even if your group isn't.
It is new, and it's a very powerful and important occurrence that we really want to see exist and grow and become stronger, because what we are trying to do is allowed this to be the vehicle through which we put forth solutions for problems in our community and approach the question of what the police have done and in the whole history of problems. And it consists of clergy persons, the various ministerial associations, business persons, traditional civil rights organizations, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Urban League, the NAACP, community activists and what have you. So it's a very broad, diverse group of folk. And the thing is that it has been the thing, in my opinion, that is responsible primarily for them not being able to attack and kill and arrest people in the Uhuru movement, because they made it quite clear that an attack on one is an attack on all, an arrest on one is an arrest of all. If one goes to jail, everybody's going to jail.
Has the African-American coalition made demands?
It has. What has happened is that the attack on our building on Wednesday happened just as I had left the meeting and then a press conference, putting forth some of the options that we were looking for as a coalition to deal with the problems. And the last thing we put forth was that the state should pull back from attacks on the Uhuru House. Of course, I left that meeting and that press conference, went to our center, and even as we had been meeting, the police were attacking our place. But yes, we had laid out various options, and within 48 to 72 hours, we were to come back and give a definitive statement to the people. And, in fact, the Wednesday meeting at 6:30, I was hoping that people from the coalition could have been there so that people could have input in what it was that we were trying to do. Of course, what happened with that attack and the rebellion on Wednesday night, we haven't been able to get together and put forth a definitive statement that we were looking for. We put in forth an economic program, and then trying to address the fact that they're attempting to close down a public housing community here for the purpose of that dome, a baseball dome. They've set right, destroyed two black communities to put it there. So we have a series of demands that we are trying to put forth, but the government continues to attack in a fashion that keep us moving in to deal with what is coming down. I can tell you that within the next day or so, we are seriously struggling to put forth demand and to regain the offensive that I think is represented by the existence of this coalition.
Amali and Rabah, we have to break, and then we're going to come back and hear just a clip of the news conference yesterday. This from Marvin Davis, a former aide to three Florida governors. You're listening to Democracy Now! Amali Ashtella and Rob Lori are our guests. We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Amali Ashtella, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, also known as the Uhuru Group, which has been under attack by the police since the verdict on Wednesday night, or the grand jury handing down the decision not to indict a police officer for shooting 18-year-old Teron Lewis, an African-American teen. We're also joined by Rob Lori, news director at WMNF in Tampa. I want to get each of your final comments very briefly. After we play this tape from the African-American Coalition that had a news conference yesterday. And this is Marvin Davies, a former aide to three Florida governors, Leroy Collins, Bob Graham, who's now senator, and Reuben Askew. He's also worked with the former President Jimmy Carter. He's part of this coalition. And this is what he had to say yesterday.
I'd just like to say that this message goes out to the mayor, to the police chief, and to all of the officers of the police force. The black community has lost trust in all of you.
Yes, that's right.
And you're going to have to earn that trust back.
Yes.
My thing is that we don't need all these white policemen out here in the black community.
No.
That's right. They were home last night, they would have been, but not anything would have happened. They need to go home.
Right.
And the police, the mayor need to tell the police chief, send them home. Let them rest at night.
Yeah.
When we'll be happy out here.
That's right.
We don't need them anymore.
No.
We really don't need them. We can police our own community.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
We don't need no white boss on the plantation to boss us around anymore. and the community is fed up.
Yeah.
We're so fed up, we're on the verge of seceding from St. Petersburg.
That's right.
I want to be the first to recommend a good name.
Right.
Jordansville, Florida.
Yeah.
And that, again, Marvin Davis, former aide to three Florida governors and worked briefly with former President Jimmy Carter. Amali Ashtella, he was not a member of the African People's Socialist Party, certainly someone that you have drawn in from the mainstream. Final comment.
I really appreciate what Marvin said. In fact, that many people are beginning now to talk about a secession movement, and it's something that we're looking at very, very closely, and I anticipate something like that will probably happen. I just want to say that we anticipate the government is going to have to find a way to justify what it has done to our movement in these rebellions, and we're looking forward to seeing serious criminal charges or something else coming down our way in an attempt to justify it. But our community is strong, it's united, and we believe that freedom and democracy is something that is attainable in our lifetime.
And Rob Lori.
Well, I just want to add one more thing about press coverage. This press conference yesterday that Amali attended was attended by about 18 other folks, a broad range of people, small business people, ministers, and all that. If you open up the paper this morning in St. Petersburg, you're not going to find any one article that's devoted to this press conference that indicates, I think, how broad the support is for Amali's group in terms of what it's trying to do to better the community and the fact that it has First Amendment rights to express itself. And the media has completely ignored, at least in my mind, the fact that there is a very legitimate group, broad-based group, that is backing Amali, and I think they ignore the coalition at their own peril.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Rob Lori, news director at WMNF in Tampa, and Amali Eshetela, the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, the community group active in St. Petersburg's South Side that's now at the center of police activity. I also want to thank Twyla Huda from WMNF for helping with this segment. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Last month, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration quietly abandoned a 50-year-old regulation requiring researchers to get a person's informed consent before conducting experiments. The FDA says the new rules are designed to protect people who might benefit from emergency research. Opponents are raising the specter of Nazi doctors and the U.S. government's radiation experiments on pregnant women, children, and prisoners. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by Dr. Peter Bregan. He's director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, which has been called the conscience of American psychiatry. He's a fierce critic of this change. But first, we turn to Mary Pendergast, who's deputy commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And I had a chance to talk to her yesterday about this new rule. She refused to be in a debate with anyone else. So we thought we'd talk to her first and then get Dr. Bregan's comment. I began by asking Mary Pendergast what this new rule actually says.
The FDA has put forward a regulation that will permit research to go forward in the situation where people are in an emergency. They're in a life-threatening situation. They cannot communicate, so they cannot consent to research. But where the medical procedures available to treat them are either non-existent or really substandard, and so we have to find new ways to help them. And what we're doing is we're permitting research to be done in this narrow class of cases without the informed consent of the person being part of the research.
Now, what about if there is a family?
Well, our basic premise is you should always get informed consent whenever you can. That's the basic underlying principle. So if there is time during what we call the therapeutic window, the seconds or minutes or hours in between the time the person has been stricken with this emergency event, car accident, heart attack, stroke, whatever, and the time that medical intervention can take place, then the researchers have the obligation to spend that time to try and find a family member or a legally authorized representative so they can get consent.
What would be the motivation for them to find a family member if they now can do this experiment without consent?
Well, they will only get approval to do the experiment without consent in circumstances, very limited circumstances, where they won't be able to get consent. So let me explain how it works. What we would do is the IRB, the Institutional Review Board of the institution, and the FDA are going to determine the limited scope of studies that this is all right for. So you have to have a life-threatening situation. You have to have available treatments that are either unproven or unsatisfactory. And we know that, like, CPR only works in a very, very small percentage of the patients. We know that research needs to be done. And it's only going to be allowed in cases where informed consent is not feasible. So what you have to do is look It will only work for subjects who cannot consent due to their medical condition, where the intervention must be done before consent from a representative is feasible, and where you can't get consent in advance. And so you have to determine scientifically what the length of that therapeutic window will be. And the researchers will have to have in place a scheme for using the therapeutic window to find the next of kin. They'll have to have informed consent forms to use for the next of kin. So if you have an hour, you have to spend the hour finding the next of kin. But there's some of these situations, like the heart attack, where you don't even have an hour. You don't even have minutes. The first couple of minutes really make the difference between life and death. And in some circumstances, the prudent thing to do would be to actually act to try and help the person. And that's something I think that it's important to know, is that we're only going to let this happen when the research holds out the prospect of direct benefit to the patients. They have to be in a situation of what's called clinical equipoise, which is to say that any therapy anybody gets in any one of these trials has to be at least as good as the therapy given to anybody else.
So, and yet they haven't been done. The experiments haven't been done on humans before, so you're not sure the effect of the drug.
Well, but you have to be careful there, because for a couple of reasons. First of all, we're going to make them do extensive animal trials. Second, we're going to make them do whatever human trials that can be done where you can get consent. And third, you've got to remember that because no research has ever been done, you don't know now. Doctors do not know now what the stuff they're doing to people and whether or not it works or not. They try their best. They are confronted with a person who is dying in a life-threatening situation. Some try this, some try that, some try something else. No systematic studies have ever been done. So the bottom line fact is at present, everybody's being experimented on. And what our goal is here is to try and shed some light on the situation and to figure out which are the things that doctors that are already doing, which ones work, which ones don't work.
If you can't find the next of kin in the time allotted, if you have a certain amount of time, then it sounds like that you're already selecting out for example, homeless people or people who don't have family. You're going to find this category of people because other people have families around.
Well, I guess I don't think that will be the case based on the information we have, but let's talk about how we address those issues. Because we know that each individual person who may be confronted with this life-threatening event isn't going to get to make the decision for his or herself because they can't. They're not capable of expressing their autonomy at that point. That we have asked the IRBs, to the institutional review boards, where the research might be done, to go out to their community and to talk to the community about this issue and to present to the community the type of research that might be done, and then to engage in a discussion, a dialogue, a consultation with the community to find out whether or not the community thinks this is appropriate research to be done for that community. So let's say you had a community where there were lots of homeless people, or that it was going to be done in an institution that serviced many homeless people in their emergency room. The community of people in that circumstance might say, this just isn't right for us. We think that the principle of justice, of having the burdens of science fall more broadly, is not met by doing this research in our institution, so we don't think the research should be done here.
Is this written in the new rule that community consultation is required?
Yes, it is. It is written into the rule. The community has to be told about the research. They have to, and then they have to, the institution that is considering doing the research must engage in a dialogue with the community.
What defines community?
It's going to depend on the type of research and where it's located. It has to be the community in which the research is being done, which is sort of a geographical sense, but also the community from which subjects will be drawn. And that is going to vary greatly depending on the type of community in this country and the type of research that's going to be done.
Who makes up the Institutional Review Board, the IRB?
The Institutional Review Board has to be made up of people from the community in which the institution is placed. And there are regulations that require that there be a cross-section of people in terms of both academic disciplines, but then and also in terms of balance between community people and medical people and things like that.
I ask that because you could have an institution, say, in a poor community where all the people in the institution are of a very different community than those who they serve.
That's right. And that's why we said that even though institutional review boards must have community people on the IRB, that we felt that it was really important here for the IRB to actually go out to their broader community and engage their broader community.
Presumably, drug companies and the makers of medical devices have a financial stake in seeing this research done since they can't get subjects like this themselves. Are they working with you on this?
They certainly... I don't recall that any companies presented. Researchers certainly presented, wanting to have permission to go forward and do research. And
researchers paid by pharmaceutical companies.
And certainly, you know, I'm certain companies responded to the rulemaking. Absolutely. I mean, and that's an important point. Companies want to do this research. Companies were not allowed to do this research. And we have to be mindful of the fact that there are economic incentives, and that's one of the reasons why we put in place lots of the different protections, such as data and safety monitoring boards, so that we can shut a study down as soon as it looks as though one group of people might be disadvantaged by the research. We put in place the public disclosure.
If a person does survive the experiment, will they be compensated then, since this is certainly going to benefit financially the drug companies?
The normal rules pertain. Remember that these are situations where the subjects are in a life-threatening situation and where available treatments are unproven or unsatisfactory. So, you have a situation when a person has a stroke, they've had a heart attack, they've broken their neck diving, let's say they've been a closed head wound from a motorcycle accident. They are going to be in very bad shape. And there, you know, it will have to be sorted out as to whether the underlying condition caused them to die or whether the experimental intervention caused them to die in a situation where they would not otherwise. And then that would have to be sorted out.
I guess the question that the critics are asking right now is many people didn't hear about this until the rule went into effect, is how the FDA can basically go against or violate the first principle of the Nuremberg Code when it comes to people being experimented on without their knowledge or without their will. How is it that the FDA, as an agency, thought that they could abrogate this first international rule or principle?
I think that the question of whether or not this rule violates the Nuremberg Code is not quite as one-sided as you stated. We consulted extensively with ethicists on the formation of this rule, and the ethical issues subsumed in this rule were something that were widely debated both in Congress, before the executive branch of government, in professional meetings, at special meetings of ethicists, and on the chat lines of the Internet. And I think that what you have to recognize is that the Nuremberg Code isn't quite as black and white as you make it, and that there are several different ethical principles that have to be taken into account. The Belmont Report talks about the principles of autonomy, beneficence, and justice that must be weighed. These patients are in a situation where they cannot express their autonomy, but that doesn't mean that we should then make no effort to meet the other ethical challenges of beneficence and justice. And what we tried to do with this rulemaking was to balance those principles in an ethical way.
Mary Pendergast, Deputy Commissioner at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. When we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Peter Bregan, Director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. His center led a successful campaign to stop federal research on urban children aimed at identifying genetic causes for violence. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman, and we're going to continue our discussion about the fact that for the first time in a half century, new federal regulations allow investigators to enroll patients in some medical research studies without their consent. The Food and Drug Administration regulations, which took effect last Friday, apply only in carefully circumscribed situations. The patients must have a life-threatening condition, like a severe head injury, and must be unable to say whether they want to be a part of a study. They would be selected only if it wasn't feasible to obtain consent from a relative, at least this according to the Food and Drug Administration. Well, you just heard from the Deputy Commissioner of the FDA, Mary Pendergast. We wish we could have engaged in a debate with our next guest, but the FDA didn't want to debate. Dr. Peter Bregan joins us, Director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, which has been called the conscience of American psychiatry. He's also on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins University Department of Counseling. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Bregan.
Hi. It's an important show you're doing today. It's really extremely important for human rights.
Well, tell us about your reaction to some of what Mary Pendergast had to say about these new regulations and what it means not to require informed consent in this limited situation.
Well, she makes it sound like it's some small thing involving regulations of an individual experiment. They're abrogating, that they are sullying the human rights of people. The Nuremberg Code is black and white. It was developed as a result of Nazi experimentations, and the whole idea behind it is you can't experiment on people against their will. And it says it outright. There's just no absolute question about it. So does the World Medical Association. Humanity has a series of rights which should be beyond the FDA, and one of those rights is you can't experiment on me against my will.
But wait a second. This is a situation, not a person being brought in and strapped to a gurney, and they're screaming, don't, and you do this to them. They're unconscious. They've perhaps suffered a severe brain injury. They're unconscious. This is Mary Pendergast's point. They are not in a position to say yes or no.
Well, that is the point. And who is not in such a position? They're going to be people brought in off the streets. They're going to be people from car accidents, people who have gunshot wounds. To a great extent, they're going to be poor people. When is it that there's no relative available? Mostly street people, but also people who have been shot on the streets, maybe criminals, people who aren't carrying identification, who are fleeing justice. It opens up a marketplace of people who aren't exactly like the doctors and their families. And this is a potential disaster, not just because of even this individual experiment. This is an assault on the basic rights. They're reversing a principle that was very hard won in human history. It's one of the most important principles there is. You can't intrude in my body in the name of medicine or science without my saying so, without my understanding, without my discussing it with you, without my signing a piece of paper. without every possible indication of consent.
And what if the drug could save your life?
Well, these drugs, we don't know whether they're going to save anybody's life. By definition, they're going to be drugs that have not been proven to be useful yet. They're drugs the companies want to market but can't market because they haven't proven either safety or efficacy. So each person is indeed an unconscious guinea pig.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Companies' interest here. Drug companies and the makers of medical devices clearly have a financial stake in seeing this research done. In fact, when I asked for the protocol for these studies, Mary Pendergast did say that the FDA doesn't have a protocol. The companies have to submit their protocol, right, have to submit the experiment they want to do, say where they want to do it, and then it goes out to the hospital connected to a medical school that will conduct this experiment. So this is all done at the company's initiative.
Well, and the company will select the doctors and the institution, and then the doctors won't even know exactly what the drug is doing because the company owns that as secrets. When I go to the FDA and I say, tell me about these studies on animals that were done for this drug that the company's trying, say Eli Lilly or Upjohn, I'm told, oh, that's proprietary. That's owned by the company. Now, what is the doctor in the emergency room going to get? He's going to get a sheet of paper that summarizes from the company's viewpoint the potential hazards of this drug. And I've been involved in legal cases already where it is clear that the drug companies have not even told the doctors giving the drugs what their dangers are. The companies really are desperate for patients, desperate for experimental subjects, and that's what this is about. And we have another breaking story going on right now. November 14th, just a day or so ago, in the Wall Street Journal, we find out that Eli Lilly has set up a clinic basically for the homeless street people, front page of the Wall Street Journal, so that they can bring people into their own closed experimental headquarters, keep people who are drying out from alcoholism and experiment on them. Are these people in a position to give consent? People who are going to get $2,500 for being injected in what's called phase one studies for FDA approval of drugs? The companies have always been desperate to get experimental subjects, and that's why they're willing to take this enormous public relations risk of abrogating the most fundamental of human rights.
I was envisioning a scenario as Mary Pendergast was talking of the companies having some protocol, doing an experiment at some hospital, and they're, I guess, I mean, are they employing the doctor? The doctor is employed by the hospital, but do they get some extra grant money to do this?
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, the physicians will be getting direct grant money for their work on these projects, for their staff. It'll support their computers and so on. In other cases, the money will go directly to the university, but that's a feather in the cap of the principal investigator, too. That gives him power.
Well, my concern was that the company needs to have this drug tested on, say, 20 people. And so you're a doctor in the emergency room and you're looking for your 20 people.
Well, exactly. Even NIH isn't immune from this kind of a scandal. In 1994, just 2 years ago, NIH was testing a drug called FIAU, hopefully for liver disease, that was produced again by Eli Lilly. And it turned out when people started to die from the drug that they made believe it wasn't the drug. They made believe or acted as if it was something that was the matter with the patient themselves, and people ended up dying in an NIH experiment sponsored by a drug company. And this resulted in yet more new regulations being proposed. It's resulted in more criticism of Eli Lilly. Well, if you can't control an experiment at NIH, you're certainly not going to be able to control it at a city hospital that isn't even in good relations with its own community.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because that's one of the points that the FDA deputy commissioner raised, is that whether you have the companies, you've got an IRB that is overlooking this. This is the institutional review board in the hospital made up of academics and also community members, and they are always reviewing these studies.
Well, the IRBs represent elitism at its worst. I mean, you get on an IRB by being a member of an old buddy network. I mean, you've got to be the local chaplain who's famous, or the local scientist who's famous, or the local ethicist who's never offended anybody so he can get onto an IRB board. These are not safety protections for anybody in any real sense of the word. IRB boards are quite old. They were involved in all of the projects that have ever been involved with scandal, including the one at NIH had to have had an IRB board. They're not a protection. And this business about going to the community is nonsense. First of all, who are the community leaders? How are they informed? What do they know about this privately owned drug that's going to be given to people? And besides, 1 year after all that's passed, everybody forgets it. And then what happens? Your daughter is in an automobile accident. She's 21 years old. You're at the theater. Your daughter gets dragged into the local emergency room. Maybe she's even directed there by the ambulance driver who knows the city hospital is having a terrible time filling its quota for head injuries. They try to get a hold of you, but you're at the theater at the Kennedy Center having a wonderful time. You get home 2 hours later. You find out your daughter's dead. And then maybe the next day you find out we gave her an experimental drug, but that wasn't what caused her death. Well, how do you know? That's what the experiment is for, is to find out whether the drug is lethal. And if the person's already got a serious near-fatal injury, you'll always be able to blame the death on the injury rather than on the drug.
We're talking to Dr. Peter Breggin. Dr. Peter Breggin is director of the Center for Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. We got a lot of faxes yesterday from the FDA after my conversation with the deputy commissioner. I had asked about who was consulted in terms of the public hearings, the organizations. And on the front of the fax, the press spokesperson said that a letter, a Dear Consumer letter, was sent to, among other groups, the National Black Nurses Association, the Alliance for the Mentally Ill of New York State, the American Medical Women's Association, the Inter-American College of Physicians and Surgeons, the National Medical Association, which is an association of African-American doctors, and also Public Citizen. And they pointed out that in one of their hearings, in one of their seminars or symposiums, a public forum on this, where they had all sorts of people participating, that there was a 12-minute talk by Annette Dula from Colorado talking about minority populations and research.
Well, almost all these organizations who spoke represent enormous vested interests. They represent professional interests. And one of my experiences in fighting racist psychiatric practices, something we describe in detail, in fact, in The War Against Children, is that yes, and this is hard to say, but just because an organization is black does not mean it is for the community. If it's a black doctor's organization, a black professor's organization, we have not found that they will necessarily take stands that will threaten medical prestige or nursing prestige or other professional communities. And that's simply the way things are organized here in the United States. I'd like to address something that hasn't been brought up at all yet, which is the broader economic motives behind this. We've all heard of NAFTA, you know, the idea that we're going to break down the boundaries and have free trade, and how does this affect our local citizenry? Well, this is, in a way, the NAFTA of medical research, because this is in part about harmonization. The FDA itself has said that. And what is harmonization? It's an attempt to lower the level of all medical experimentation to one common denominator throughout Europe and the United States and Canada. And it's as a part of harmonization that we're attacking this most fundamental human right. Now, who wants harmonization? The drug companies, because if they can get the same rules in every country, and if those rules can be looser in every country, then all they need is to get drug approval in Italy or Germany or Switzerland, and then it will be good in the entire community because it will have met the same rules. So this is definitely a part of the international drug industry's attempt to make it faster, quicker, cheaper, and easier to produce drugs. You can be pretty sure they're not going to exactly pass on the savings to the consumer.
You know, I said earlier, Dr. Breggin, that you had led a successful campaign to stop federal research on urban kids, mainly African-American children, aimed at identifying genetic causes for violence. Do you see any connection here?
Well, there's a tremendous connection. I mean, the federal government literally 3 years ago was trying to organize itself, all of its health agencies, to go into America's inner cities to conduct experiments, starting with pregnant mothers and infants, to show that when kids grew up developed to be violent. It was biological and genetic. They were going to ignore racism, poverty, the school systems, unemployment, and all the other major issues, and try to blame it on the individual's bodies. And we felt that this was very, very racist and very much aimed at poor people and very much aimed at social control. And in fact, none of the major institutions that were invited to this FDA hearing spoke out against this kind of research, because it was opening up new markets for the drug companies and new markets for the researchers. Researchers are always looking for new ways to make money. We ended up defeating this program with a grassroots program, very much, by the way, involving Radio Pacifica. I was on all of the sister and brother stations multiple times talking about the violence initiative. And then, interestingly enough, eventually BET, Black Entertainment Television, took a big role. It was long after that the mainstream media began to criticize the violence initiative. So you could bring together all the mainstream institutions in the world to examine regulations like this and still let the FDA say something like the Nuremberg Code isn't black and white. It's absolute.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up. But if people want to get in touch with your center that continues to monitor this kind of activity, the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, what number can they call?
301-652-5580.
That's 301-652-5580. We want to thank you very much, Dr. Peter Bregan, director of the Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, who wrote a letter to the New York Times in response to the piece they had on the lifting of this 50-year-old principle, the idea of informed consent for all medical experiments. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and now we're going to go to a few phone calls that have come in over the last few days as we asked for suggestions for taglines for our show now that we're not the grassroots election show anymore, at least the election part of it we're not, and also just comments on the show. This is what people have had to say.
This is Donna in Houston. I listen to you on KPFT. I think you are the best thing that's happened to radio in my lifetime. Tagline might have something like, we diss demagoguery, down with demagoguery. I consider Democracy Now! To be my daily political reality check.
Hi, this is Ellen. I'm calling from California, and I wanted to say that I think that the boycott that Reverend Jesse Jackson has just announced of Texaco is an excellent idea. I also think that there should be a joint boycott against Texaco and Shell because of Shell's conspiracy with the Nigerian government to murder 2,000 Ogoni workers and to assassinate the 9 Ogoni environmentalists, Ken Sarawiwa and other 8 people, more recently.
This is Gershon Berman from Mountain View, California. I just heard your program today with Jesse Jackson urging a boycott of Texaco. Now, this is well and good, except for the fact that most, if not all, of the other major oil companies that sell gasoline are guilty of perhaps even worse oppressive policies in various countries, as well as pollution in this country. I would really like it if somebody could come out with some recommendations as to which, if any, oil companies might be considered the lesser of evils, because it's getting very difficult to decide where to buy gasoline, and so far I've failed at getting any good recommendations from any of the progressive organizations concerned about policies of oil companies. Thank you.
Hi, this is Bruce McCarter from Santa Rosa, California. And my suggestion for the tagline is this. Democracy Now!, it's your call.
Yeah.
Hey, I like that. Democracy Now!, it's your call. And we hope you do call in and comment on the show and give us suggestions for a new Democracy Now! Tagline. Our number is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. No, we're not changing our name. It is still Democracy Now!. still a demand, but we are changing our tagline. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin and Dan Coughlin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!